sitting alone in the eve and viewing the skies afar, bidding the darkness come to welcome each silver star. I have great delight in the wonderful scenes above. God in His power and might is showing His truth and love. Sitting alone in the eve and dreaming the hours away, watching the shadows falling now at the close of day. God in His mercy comes, with His word He is drawing near, spreading His love and truth around me and everywhere. Closing my eyes at eve and thinking of heaven's grace, long to see my Lord, yes, meeting Him face to face. Trusting Him as my all, wheresoever my footsteps roam, pleading with Him to guide me onto the Spirit's home. And then the chorus, oh, for a home with God, a place in His courts to rest, sure in a safe abode with Jesus and the blessed. Rest for a weary soul once redeemed by the Savior's love, where I'll be pure and whole and live with my God above. And I couldn't help but think that an evolutionist could never sing the song. If God hasn't been able to prepare a place for man to live here, how in the world could He prepare a place for man to live when this life is over? As you study evolution, you have a deep sense of concern and compassion for people who've been caught up in the theory. Tonight we're going to deal with the effects of it in the lives of people. And when you begin to realize all the implications and complications in a person's life that's brought about by the theory of evolution, you begin to appreciate the fact that evolution, people who believe in evolution, are not going to go to heaven. We'll talk more about it tonight. But the entire structure of 20th century life is affected by the theory of evolution. There's hardly a college or university in the land that doesn't teach it. And the high school texts are full of it. And even our boys and girls, when they go off to grade school, are occasionally confronted with a theory. And you know, when you talk about young people and they're having to be confronted with it at that age in life, there are a couple of problems that make it even more difficult. One is that their young minds are less prepared to separate truth from error. And then another thing is that when you're at that age, people with a number of letters behind their names overwhelm you. I can remember when I was a boy thinking that a fellow who had a PhD could nearly walk on the water, and that surely everything he said must be, you know, truth. And then as you live, you begin to realize that these are just people who've stuck with it until they've gotten some more education. That's all they've done. And they're not super people at all. And if our young people can remember that when these PhDs or whoever begin to throw the theory at them, realize that they're simply men who've delved into worldly wisdom maybe a little further than some people have, that there's nothing about them that's any different than anybody else. We're all going to have to come back to basic things. We're going to please God when life is over. But through TV and the radio and magazines and other means perhaps of mass communication, every one of us are exposed to the theory of evolution. And the danger lies not so much in the theory, but in the way in which it's proposed. That is, it's presented as a fact and not as a theory. If it were all the time presented as a theory, the danger would not be nearly as great as what it is. Mr. Arthur Kornberg, who in 1959 shared the Nobel Prize for Medicine, stated, "Evolution is beyond dispute. It is a fact of nature as compelling as gravity." There's our danger. And there never has been a greater untruth ever spoken than that. Well, someone was telling me about the professor in his classroom one time holding up his handkerchief. He was lecturing on evolution. Held up his handkerchief and let it drop. And then he said, "You can prove evolution just like you can prove gravity." And it's just not so. And I want to say this at this particular juncture, that if there should be anybody here who knows of anybody in the intellectual community in Knoxville who wants to discuss the matter publicly, even though I haven't cleared with my brother and I know them well enough to know that West Knoxville will pay their share of the expenses involved and will have a public discussion of these things. It's not something that preachers just get up and talk about without basis, but we're willing to have the thing aired publicly and share our part of the expenses in that public discussion. of evolution. It's not a proven fact at all. It is a theory. From beginning to end, it's a theory and has not been proven at all. And what I'm saying is that if it had been presented in this light all down through the years, the danger would not have been as great. Down in Arkansas, they just have closed a trial recently where the citizens of Arkansas were endeavoring by court to have the theory of creation presented alongside the theory of evolution. And the judge, you know, ruled against creationists because he said creationism is not a science. But evolution is not a science either. You can't go in the laboratory and do anything to prove evolution. And of course, nobody can go in the laboratory and prove creation. It's a faith. And evolution is a faith. It's something that people believe. But so far as being able to prove it in the laboratory, it's not a scientific thing or not something open to scientific investigation. And it has not been proven that way. And all these people in Arkansas were asking was that when it's taught in the high school and the school system in the state of Arkansas, that the theory of evolution be taught as a theory, and at the same time, the possibility of creation be taught alongside of. And let a person make up his mind which theory he believes is the most logical, which one he wants to believe. That's what the people of Arkansas were asking for. And it seems to me that in our school system, that there ought to be equal time for those who believe that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And when it comes down to it, there's a great deal more evidence for God having created, certainly, than there is for the theory of evolution. There are a lot of scientists who recognize the limitations of evolution, and there are a lot of scientists who do not believe in it at all. The book that I hold in my hand, The Implications of Evolution, by G. A. Kirkhood, who is in the biology department, the University of Southampton in England, is an evolutionist. He believes the theory, but in the introduction of his book, he says, "May I here humbly state, as a part of my biological credo, that I believe that the theory of evolution as presented by orthodox evolutionists is in many ways a satisfying explanation of some of the evidence. At the same time, I think that the attempt to explain all living forms in terms of an evolution from a unique source, through a unique source, though a brave and valid attempt, is one that is premature and not satisfactorily supported by present-day evidence." That's a recognized evolutionist who made the statement. If all of them would be that honest, then we wouldn't have as much danger to our young people as we have at the present time. "We can," he says, "if we like, believe that such an evolutionary system has taken place, but I, for one, do not think that it has been proven beyond all reasonable doubt." He said, "I don't believe that it's been proven beyond all reasonable doubt." From The American Scientist, June 1961, page 240, a man who is an evolutionist reviewed Mr. Kirkhut's book. His name is John Tyler Bonner, and he says this is a book, as he talks about this one that came out in 1960, he says this is a book with a disturbing message. It points to some unseemly cracks in the foundations. One is disturbed because what is said gives us the uncanny or the uneasy feeling that we knew it for a long time deep down, but were never willing to admit this even to ourselves. It is another of those cold and uncompromising situations where the naked truth and human nature travel in different directions. Then on over on page 157, Mr. Kirkhut makes this observation. "There's the theory that all living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from inorganic form. This theory can be called the general theory of evolution, and the evidence that supports it is not sufficiently strong to allow us to consider it as anything other than a working hypothesis. And a hypothesis is an assertion subject to verification or proof." You make an assertion, and then that assertion is subject to proof. That's what a hypothesis is. And he said it's nothing more than a working hypothesis or a theory that's subject to proof, and the proof has not yet been given. But a lot of these fellows that are teaching in our high schools and colleges and universities get before their classes and present as absolute truth these ideas. This is what we're saying is makes one of the dangers of the system today. What is evolution? The word itself means an unrolling. If you've been to a wedding lately, before the bride comes in to the wedding chapel, some young men come down and they pick up a roll of cloth and they spread it out from where the wedding is to take place all the way to the back of the building. That's evolution. It's an unrolling. That's all it is. Now, when you use the word more specifically regarding a theory of how living things came to be what they are today, then the theory proposes that dead matter, acting upon itself, spawned a very simple form of life, one cell organism, which by chance evolved into higher forms of life over a period of millions of years. The microorganisms evolved into multicellular organisms, like invertebrates, that is, things without backbone, and which in turn eventually became fishes or vertebrates. And the fishes evolved into amphibians, frogs, toads, etc. The amphibians into reptiles, the reptiles into mammals, the mammals into monkeys and apes, and the apes into man. And they say, of course, that plant life was evolving at the same time. That's the theory of evolution. There are just a number of assumptions. If you take away the assumptions, you have nothing left. So there are a number of assumptions you've got to allow an evolutionist in order for him to get going with his theory. Mr. Kirka talks about the assumptions. He says there are seven basic assumptions. Number one is that non-living things gave rise to living material. Spontaneous generation, he says, puts it down here. That's an assumption. You've got to allow. Life had to come somewhere. You've got to allow an assumption that life started spontaneously. Number two, the second assumption is that spontaneous generation occurred only one time. If not, why then it's occurring right now. New life is just forming out of nothing or out of dead material all the time. But you have to allow the evolutionist the assumption that it just occurred one time. The third assumption is that viruses, bacteria, plants, and animals are interrelated. Number four, the fourth assumption that the protozoa gave rise to the metazoa. Fifth assumption is that the various invertebrate phyla are interrelated. Number six, the assumption that the invertebrates gave rise to the vertebrates. And number seven, the assumption that is that within the vertebrates, the fish gave rise to the amphibia to the reptiles to the birds and the mammals. This sometimes is expressed in other words as that the modern amphibia and reptiles had a common ancestral stock. He lists seven assumptions that you've got to allow an evolutionist in order for him to get started, you know. If you don't allow these assumptions, then he can't go anywhere. And before that, of course, you've got to allow him an assumption about matter being eternal. He's got to assume that matter's always been here, eternal. And then he has a Big Bang explosion, but the Big Bang theory is, I think, for the universe come into existence, you've got to allow that, you know, and all such things as that. And when you begin to get right down to the nitty-gritty, you begin to wonder, how in the world can anybody have such a faith as that in his heart? The arguments made for evolution are numerous. Let me suggest to you five or six or seven of them this morning. One of them is natural selection. Charles Darwin, you know, back in 1859, came out with Origin of the Species. And this, of course, gave impetus to this particular theory about which we speak. But this theory is held by Darwin and what they call neo-Darwinists, new Darwinists. Natural selection involves simply the survival of the fittest. And even if this is allowed as being a means by which there is development, it would only have to be retained to a species. The very fact that the fittest survive would only mean that the species would improve. And you wouldn't be able to get outside the species with natural selection or survival of the fittest. But you know, as you look around, survival of the fittest is sort of a discouraging thing to observe. Have you ever bought real good roses and then neglected your rose garden? And some of these days, they degenerate. Suppose you have some real fine race horses on your farm, and you just let them run wild with all the other horses around. You know what's going to happen in a few years? You've lost your strain of race horses. I don't care what you're talking about. If it just runs wild in nature, the species does not really improve, it degenerates. You begin to wonder about the validity of natural selection so far as bringing about evolution and coming from a one-cell organism all the way up to where man is at the present time. A second thing that's used to endeavor to prove the theory of evolution is this matter of random mutations. A mutation is a change in genetic structure of a reproductive cell that results in the development of a new or different characteristic in the offspring. It's admitted that genetic structure can be altered by radioactivity. Mutations can be brought about by man in the laboratory. But Professor Mueller, on the faculty of Indiana University at Bloomington, Indiana, in 1946, won the Nobel Prize for his work in mutations. And in the speech that Mr. Mueller gave in accepting the Nobel Prize for his work in mutations, said, "Most mutations are bad. Good ones are so rare that we can consider them as all bad." This is reported in Time magazine, November the 11th, 1946, on page 38. They're so rare, good ones are, that you can consider all of them as being bad. And so of what value is the random mutation argument when there's so seldom a good one comes along, where it would cause a rise in intellectual brain structure and a development of eye and all such things as that, when most mutations are bad instead of good? A fellow some time back performed this experiment. He had two dice and he rolled them, endeavoring to get double ones, double twos, double threes, and so on. He had to roll them 224 times to get double ones, double twos, double threes, and so on. But the problem was he didn't get them in order. He got double ones and double sixes and double threes, but they all mixed up, you know. But it took 224 rolls to get all the doubles, six doubles. But they didn't come in order. And it took him 4 minutes to roll 224 times. Now, he figured, mathematically, that if he had 40 dice, and he rolled those 40 dice once every second he rolled the 40 dice, in order to get a different combination on those 40 dice, the possible combination just one time, enrolling them one time every second, it would take him 1,000,000 years to just get the one combination, each of the combinations one single time, and then not in order. See what we're trying to say? If by chance, and that's all it is, if by chance you've got random mutations, you've got to have them back to back in some way to move forward and develop from a one-cell organism all the way through up to where we are at the present time. You think of the chance involved. This is what evolutionists want you to believe. Sometimes our young people are impressed with their educational attainments, the fellows who present the theory, and just swallow it like a little baby bird with his eyes shut, swallows the worm that the mother drops in his mouth. It's ridiculous. The chance element that's involved in evolution. At the Super Bowl game a Sunday or two ago, when a past star came out, and I don't think it was a coin, I think it was a larger than that, but it had a head and tails on it. And he flipped, and I forgot the middle, we'll say it came up head. Would you believe me if I told you that fellow could flip 1,000 heads without a single tail? You've got evolutionists telling that chance has flipped millions of heads, you know, to get all these changes from one cell organism all the way up to man. Can you believe that? The evolutionists are asking us to believe that we're the result of an incredible number of incredible accidents that makes the whole theory incredible. It's unbelievable that all these chances could have taken place. But you know, when they begin to talk about chance, one thing they need is a lot of time. A lot of it, you know. You know, you limit them to 1,000 years, they'd be down the drain. The Smithsonian magazine is the last thing I ran across recently, and Brother Clark went to another doctor. He didn't have it in himself, but he went to another doctor and borrowed it for me, and you're welcome to look at it. But it has a large fold-out. They're going to, they are at the present time, erecting or building in the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., this 27-foot mural that's going to start with one cell organism and then all the way up this mural if I have man at the top of it, you know. And the thing is going to be labeled 700 million years of development. But when you read the article, they really want 6.5 billion. 6.5 billion years. That's when they say life began in the sea. 6.5 billion years ago. You know how much a billion is? If you had $1 billion and you laid in $1 bills and you laid them around the earth end to end, they'd go around the earth four times. And then if you picked them up one every second and worked 40 hours a week, it would take you 147 years to pick them all up. That's how much 1 billion is. And they want 6.5 billion years. They want us to go back 6.5 billion to the first form of life in the ocean. Where'd the ocean come from? Well, you're going to have to assume there was an ocean, you know, and all such as that. But you get all that time in there, you know, and then that sort of overwhelms you, you know, all that time element. But then in this article, in this mural, they're going to start at 700 million years and then work right back to year zero. That's where we are at the present time. And they say in the article now that man's only been here 40,000 years. And so if in the mural, if man was pictured, you know, in a harmony with other things, then man would only be a less than an inch high on the mural. But they're going to put it in full scale, I guess, or somewhat near that. But that's the time frame in which the whole thing falls. Random mutations. Chance. But all of them have to be so many of them working together in the right direction, you know. Incredible. Then comparative anatomy is another thing that's used in order to try to prove evolution. By comparative anatomy, they mean that you take the skeletal part of a man and lay it down beside the skeleton of a dog or whatever, that there are comparisons to be made, there are similarities between the two. And so since there are similarities between the two, the assumption of the evolutionists is that they evolved, you know, one from the other, and that one is in the course of evolvement until you finally get up to man. I jotted down a statement that I saw made, that evolutionists are convinced that the 4 feet of the dog and the wings of the bat, the flippers of the whale, and the hands of man contain essentially the same bones, muscles, etc. And so they say they have descended from a common ancestor. Suppose that our generation, our society, were suddenly completely wiped off the face of the earth, so far as living people are concerned. And then several thousand years later, people come back and inhabit this part of the globe, and in digging around, they discover a riding lawnmower, and somewhere else, a Ford automobile. And so, they say, evolution. The riding lawnmower was first. Then that thing that spins underneath that cuts grass, you know, that became a vestigial organ. We'll talk about that in a little bit. That became a vestigial. That became an organ that wasn't necessary anymore in the evolutionary process, because you get up to the bigger wheels and the automobiles, don't anything to cut things that impedes progress as it moves along. But you've got evolution. But it doesn't prove evolution, because the
riding lawnmower has four wheels and a steering wheel and a brake and you can turn the lights on. Doesn't prove evolution at all because they're similar to an automobile. Or it is similar to an automobile. It simply proves a common designer. Man designed them both. You know a reason that a man and a dog have some characteristics in common? Well, the same designer. And they live in the same environment. And they have somewhat the same needs, you know. We all need food and water and all. And so, why wouldn't God design one similar to the other since we live in the same environment and so on? They had the same designer. That's all it shows. Rather than ancestry, it shows design. And then there's the theory of embryonic recapitulation, they say, that helps to prove evolution. But I agree with you now that it's a pretty outdated idea, that not many evolutionists hold the thing today, but I thought it'd be wise to mention it because I ran across the fact that a textbook was published in 1969 and used in high schools. That's only 12 years ago. And it taught embryonic recapitulation. By embryonic recapitulation, they simply mean that the human embryo in the mother's womb in 9 months relives all of the stages through which man has evolved. Authorities say that anybody can identify a human embryo at 49 days. And that doctors, those skilled in these matters, at 30 days can identify a human embryo. And the article that I read said that they had never at any time would anybody ever mistake a human embryo for a fish or a reptile. There is no such thing as embryonic recapitulation. And as we said, most evolutionists have a good while ago let loose off this particular idea. And then another thing that they endeavor to use to prove evolution is this matter of vestigial organs. I went to my American Heritage Dictionary for the word vestigial, and they say in biology it means a small degenerate or rudimentary organ or part existing in an organism as a usually non-functioning remnant of an organ or part fully developed and functional in a preceding generation or earlier developmental stage. Or, to state it maybe a little more simply, there are organs in a man's body that doctors do not know the purpose of. And evolutionists have latched on to those particular organs and said, when those organs were necessary, they played a part in the individual when he was back yonder in some of the stage of development, in the reptile stage or wherever, you know, he needed that organ. But now that he's up where he is now, the body still has it, but there's no longer use for it. And supposedly, in the evolutionary process, eventually that organ will be eliminated from the body. 1900, they had a list of 180 vestigial organs. In 1929, a man by the name of Charles Smith, who was then at that time president of the American Atheist Association, he said the number was about 100. That's 1929. Today, they say that any man who would affirm more than 6 or 8 would be a radical. If we have dropped from 180 in 1900, or from 100 in 1929, down to about a half dozen today, what's going to happen in the next 50 years? It just means that man's getting a little smarter. And God put those things in there for a reason. There's not one single thing in our body. But what God didn't design for a purpose, and a man may never know what it is, but God put it there, and it's there for a purpose. I read in Reader's Digest some time back that the tonsils, which they include in the vestigial organ classification, the tonsils and the appendix, probably, the Reader's Digest article say, probably play a part in the warding off arthritis. When I was a boy, you weren't in unless you'd had your appendix and your tonsils out. Everybody, you know, My folks didn't believe in ever calling a doctor unless you were pretty near death, and I didn't get either one of mine out. But about everybody did if they had the money to get it done. Now we've gone beyond that, and doctors now are saying, leave them in there. If you can leave them in there at all, leave them in. There's a purpose for it. The evolutionists, of course, have red faces over this matter of vestigial organs and the arguments they used to make about them and the number of them they listed and all such things as that. But then the fossil records. And probably we'd be agreed that this would be the strongest argument that evolutionists have in an effort to prove the theory of evolution. A fossil, of course, is a part of an organism that's more durable, like the bones or the teeth or whatever, and its remains are left in rock, and you can see the outline of them there. You can see them there in digging around. Probably most all of us have seen things like that, if not actually seen them somewhere we've seen them in museums. And what evolutionists do is to name these 12 different rock layers, and then they endeavor to date the age of the rocks or the age of the fossils. And you know, as you begin to listen to them talk about these things, you'd think that somewhere in the world there was a place where these 12 layers of rocks are all there in that order, and that's just not so. And you can go to places where layer number 11 is laying on top of layer number 1. But they want to disregard matters like that, you know. And they want to build this hypothetical thing and try to prove that life has grown from simpler forms over the years. I think as Brother Clark was talking to me in the vestibule a week or so ago about the missing link, and he pointed out to me that those of us who teach on it and talk about it, you know, have made a mistake in the past by using the singular. I believe it's Brother Clark who said this, but anyway, it's true. And I went back and looked at my notes that I'd made for this lesson, and I had singular down there. The missing link is the problem. Well, it's not the missing link, it's the missing links. There are no forms intermediate between this and this. You evolve from a reptile into something else, and there are no intermediate forms. You've got these forms and these forms, but the intermediate forms you don't have. And the missing links are there. They're not there. They're gone. If it's just one link they're looking for, it'd be different. But they're looking for all of them. All those intermediate forms they do not have. None of them do they have. If I were lecturing on evolution another period of time and our civilization has been wiped out by some catastrophe, and I was affirming that a T-model Ford evolved into a 747 jet. You know what somebody would want? Would be some intermediate forms, you know. You'd have the Piper Cub and right on down. You'd have the evolution of the airplane, using the word in a good sense. But show me where the intermediate forms between the automobile and the airplane are. If the automobile evolved into the 747 jet, there ought to be some intermediate forms between the automobile, half automobile, and half airplane. They're just not there. We're talking about the evolution theory and them saying that they've got these fossils and they can prove evolution right on up the scale, and the intermediate forms they do not possess. And so what we're trying to say to our young people especially today is that evolution just has not been proven. And I want to close, even though we may repeat ourselves tonight, I want to close by saying that it's a serious, serious situation. And some of you I may not have back tonight. You may not come back tonight. And I might not be able to get to speak to you tonight. But I want to tell you that the very minute that you accept the theory of evolution, God has to go out the door. Now, it's a fact that there are what they call theistic evolutionists. But I have more regard, I have a greater respect for out-and-out atheistic evolutionists than I have for theistic evolutionists. Those who try to compromise and try to hold on to the best of both worlds are disgusting, to me, a disgusting group of people. and try to argue that God oversaw the evolutionary process and he put that one cell organism there, and then he guided the evolution of that into a little bit better form, and so on, until finally over 700 million years or 6.5 billion years, we finally get up. The Bible doesn't teach a thing like that at all. And I tell you, when you believe evolution, you don't believe in Jesus Christ anymore. An absolute impossibility. Jesus said, "Have you not read that he that made in the beginning made the male and female? And he said, for this cause shall man leave father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. For the Lord, there are no more two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder." Jesus didn't believe in evolution. Jesus believed in spatial creation, just like Genesis 1 and 2 teaches. And if that's not so, Jesus is the biggest liar and the hypocrite and falsifier that ever lived. He's not the Son of God if evolution is so. And if Jesus Christ is the Son of God, then God created the heavens and the earth, and he made man and woman and placed them in the Garden of Eden. Jesus believed it. And I tell you, there's no middle ground. You'll either be a follower of Jesus Christ and give your life to him and believe what the New Testament teaches and the Old Testament teaches, or deny the divinity of the Son of God. But one thing before we close, one other thing. Somebody said, well, what about the age of the world? That just blows my mind. You know, isn't it true that they can prove the world is older than 6,000 years? To me, there is not one single problem involved in these discussions and arguments over the age of the world. Let me suggest to you three possibilities, and then we'll close the lesson. If you open your Bibles to Genesis 1, look at the wording of it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The heaven and the earth. Verse 2, and the heaven, the earth, and the earth was without form and void. It was empty, for the word void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved on the face of the water. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. So we had the beginning of day one of creation. That's so far as material things and the things that make up this world. But in the beginning, God. And then, in 6 days, he brought order out of chaos. And he put animals and insects and trees and man and everything else in. But in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the whole point is how much time between the beginning and the 6 days of creation. How much time? And anybody who opens his mouth is speculating, right? Nobody knows how much time between the beginning and the 6 days. And a second thing, God made Adam and Eve. Made Adam out of the dusty ground, then put him to sleep in the rib of his side. You talk about a theistic evolutionist trying to explain that. How would you take a rib out of the side of a one cell organism? Massive protoplasm walking around the water. God took a rib out of Adam's side, made the woman, brother the man, what the Bible says about it. But you know, when Adam and Eve were made, standing there together, day one, in the Garden of Eden, how old did they look? Were they wallowing on their backs and kicking their legs with no teeth and crying? Or were they grown men and women? How old did they look? One day old, how old did they look? There were all these trees growing in the Garden of Eden. Were they just little old sprouts that just start little things staying in the ground? Were they growing trees? How old did the trees look? They were one day old the day when they were made, the third day. How old did they look? And suppose you'd been there and had dug down in the ground. How old would things under the ground look? Would there have been oil and coal and iron and gold and all those things under the ground? Why, of course. God didn't make the upper side of the earth, men, women, and trees, to look to be years and years old, and then under the ground, look one day old. We wouldn't have done that. He made it, created looking old. Of course he did. And the idea, if somebody comes along and says, I can dig down, I can show you how that's been there older than 6,000 years or whatever, I'm not trying to put any length of time on when man was created, but to dig down there and prove to his over. Why, God made it look old.
like it made Adam look 40 or whatever. I'll tell you a third thing I would get like that. I'm going to keep on saying it because somebody can do something about it, but, you know, in a convincing way. Adam and Eve made a place in the Garden of Eden, and they were sinless. And they had fellowship with God, and they lived in a tree. How long did that go on? Before sin came, you would just think 2 or 3 days maybe. How long did it go on? You've got to speculate. You've got to speculate if you say how long it went on. How does God count time? God's eternal. How old is God? God's eternal. You don't count God's age in years. He's eternal. And when Adam and Eve were made, they had access to the tree of life. They didn't get one day older. They didn't age it. You think they might have lived there 1 million years before they sinned? You may laugh, but I tell you, you don't know how long they lived there before they sinned. And it's my judgment that their age wasn't counted until the sins began to get older. Why would you count my age when he's eternal? Then when he sinned, then after he sinned, he lived 930 years before he died. The evolutionists are so smart, but there's just a lot of things they don't know. Then to make fun of some of us who talk about creation, all such and things. What I'm trying to say is hold on to your faith in God. And there's not one solitary thing that you have more precious than your faith in God, in Jesus Christ, and in the veracity of the Scripture. What greater thing do you have? I'll tell you, if you lose your faith in God, the fact that Jesus is God's Son, and the Bible is the Word of God, you're going to go to hell. You can't do it. You let somebody take your faith away from you, and they've taken the most precious thing away from you to take it. We're pleased for faith in God and faith in the Word of God as God's revelation of man. If you're here and you're not a Christian, we want you to be one. If you're here and a child of God is not a faithful child, we want you to come back home. That's right. Right now, we're going to be standing.